The California Dreaming Podcast is brought to you by Blueberry. There is more to making a podcast than just talking into your mic and hitting publish. You're going to need a little bit more than that. And I'm talking about reliable hosting so your time can be spent working on your show. You want accurate download numbers, you want to see the audience that you're reaching, and you're going to want a webpage that is simple and easy to work with. That's why I've chosen to use Blueberry. It's simple media hosting and fully integrated WordPress website. It can't get any easier, especially for someone like me who knows nothing. If you host a show or you're thinking about starting one, visit www.orbitaljigsaw.com/dream to give it a try for a month for free. Their dedicated support team will be right there to help you every step of the way. And with 1 month for free using our promo code DREAM, you've got no more excuses to start up that podcast that you keep talking about starting. There are a number of ways that you can support California Dreaming. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can spread the word about the show. You can recommend us in podcast and true crime fan groups. And you can leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you've recently gone over there and left a nice review, I want to thank you so much because my star rating went back up to 4.5, so I'm just going to stop looking at it from there. If you did leave me a review and you want to show me, I'd love to see a screenshot as long as it's a nice review. You can send that to me on Messenger or email or wherever you can find me. If you would like to go a little above and beyond, you can support the show on Patreon. You can gain access to at least one exclusive episode per month, and there are currently more than 50 episodes that you can binge, so it's a pretty good deal starting at just $1. In addition, there are about 8 premium episodes for supporters at the $5 and above tiers, and also we have recently added the option of an annual subscription, which can save you 15%. And while I think I've been fairly consistent bringing you the monthly bonuses, now that I have some loyal subscribers that are paying for the annual subscription, well, then I'll have to be extra fairly consistent. I haven't had any new patron thank yous in a couple of weeks, so I'm going to thank some of you on this episode and then some of you on the next. Kelly Grace, thank you for reminding me about adding the option about a week or so ago, and Mary Virginia had actually been the first one to mention it a couple months ago, so thank you ladies for reaching out to me about it, and thank you both for signing up for that. I'd also like to thank Jen P, Carrie, Joan, Tessa S, Tony M, Kara M, and Maddie for joining and supporting Patreon. And I'd also like Nia C. and Jennifer for raising their pledge to the next level. If you've also recently joined Patreon or you've also signed up for the annual subscription, I will get your thank you in on the next episode. You can also help with a one-time donation through our PayPal using our email at californiapod@gmail.com. Thank you all so much for continuing to support this show in every way that you have been. And every way that you will hopefully continue to do so. Before we begin this episode, I must provide you with this warning. It contains some details involving child sexual abuse and sexual assault and may be disturbing or triggering for some listeners. So listener discretion is advised. Also, thank you for waiting for this episode. I was really, honestly ready to have this recorded and published for you in 2020, but to hell with 2020, so let's go. I hope all of my dreamers had a really nice holiday and a great new year as much as possible during these weird times. As I started researching the story, I was in California visiting with my daughter. On the drive over here, I listened to an episode of the Dateline podcast. And it was a story that they covered I vaguely remembered happening close to the area where I grew up, lived, and worked most of my life. The story started in 1995, and when it happened, I was only 20. As a matter of fact, I came to find that I was born the same year as the central character in this case. Our paths may have even crisscrossed here or there, as we were both out and about in and around Orange County, California in those years. I hadn't seen the Dateline episode when it had aired several years ago, so when I began listening to the podcast, immediately I was like, I remember this, but not so much when it came to all the details and the minutiae and what ultimately ended up happening. I listened very intently as I drove. As I went along, there was something about what I was listening to that was really rubbing me the wrong way, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but as the woman in the story who was doing most of the talking, as she was being interviewed by the Dateline correspondent, she was actually, at some point in this case, the victim or the survivor, if you will, and at other points where I wasn't feeling that as much. And you know, in the few stories that we've covered over the years where there is a survivor who lived to tell what happened to them, we, and I mean you and I listening together, we find ourselves somewhat emotionally connected to the survivor and their story because we're able to see them and hear them and feel what they endured and what they lived through, because so many times in these cases, we may only hear from family and friends and loved ones to tell the story because there wasn't a survivor to be had. There have been times when I think some of us have even shed a tear or two as we've become so deeply invested in what we're listening to. We can't help it. We're human, and some of us are more emotional and sensitive than others. I've tried to suck it up and get through some of these really tough cases, and there are times when I just can't make it through. I guess that's why I'm not really a professional at this, I suppose. Anyway, I like hearing stories told directly from the survivor, the one who lived it and lived through it, to share it with us and bring us along on their journey. And it's particularly satisfying to know that being able to live and talk about it on TV or on shows or even in podcasts is kind of a catharsis for them. And it's satisfying for us because we know justice was served, and while life may never be the same for the person that this happened to, they are able to find strength and carry on, and we get to see that. There may be some hurt and some scars that this person will carry with them, but they're still going and they're still trying. It's a little bit of a silver lining in this typically dark world of true crime. But this case I was listening to was different. I was hearing the words of the survivor, but I just wasn't connecting with her story like I have in other cases in the past. And I said a moment ago, I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. Why am I not empathizing with her feelings and what she had gone through? And it bugged me as I was going along heading to California. So I listened to the podcast again, and then I listened to it again, and I still wasn't feeling it. As a matter of fact, I think my opinion of this woman changed a little bit, but not for the better. And it was bothering me that I was feeling so cynical about this. So I searched for the story in my podcast app, and I found that it had been covered a couple of years ago by one show that is relatively well known that I do occasionally listen to, and it's hosted by two guys. And while I usually don't have a problem mentioning other podcasts by name, I'm not going to do it this time. But if you have to know, you can message me and I'll tell you. The story was also featured on maybe another smaller podcast. I don't think I've heard of it before. And I believe it was a Spanish language podcast. So why would I have listened to it? Because I don't speak Spanish. So anyway, I listened to the episode on the well-known true crime podcast, and I found myself disagreeing with the opinions of both of the hosts. Let me see if I can word this in a way that's not offensive to anyone. But okay, so I know covering a story that involves sexual assault and surviving sexual assault is a very delicate topic. And any host that is knowledgeable and aware, whether they are male or female, they're perfectly capable of conveying the story with a measure of understanding and sympathy. However, when I listened to these guys take on the story, I started to feel like they kind of maybe tried a little bit too hard when it came to rallying in support of the woman at the center of the story and condemning the justice system that she was facing. And I don't want to come off sounding like a jerk here, so bear with me, and you'll eventually see where I'm coming from. But I felt in their telling, there was too much fear in offending listeners or saying the wrong thing or getting raked over the coals on social media for being insensitive to survivors, to a point where a complete picture of what was actually going on in the periphery was lost. It was kind of like the hosts almost censored themselves a little bit too much, and a chunk of the story went missing. And I understand why. We know that there are hosts that also happen to be men who have faced some backlash on social media when speaking about certain women's issues where they've missed the mark. I'm not really one to get offended by that sort of stuff. I've been sent messages myself from a handful of male listeners who have been offended by things that I may have said in the past about toxic masculinity. So it cuts both ways. I wasn't offended by what these guys had to say about this story, but I just didn't think it was a comprehensive view. In a nutshell, the message that I was getting from them was, she's the victim, and shame on anyone who challenges her story. She's been victimized enough, so leave her alone. But the reason I searched for another take on this case was pretty much for that exact reason. I was listening to this victim slash survivor, but was unable to take what she was saying at face value. If I had, then I probably wouldn't have even sat down to write this. There's already a couple podcasts about it. I listened to all of it, so move on to the next thing, right? It's not quite working that way for me, at least not for this case. There's been a couple of times when there have been listeners who have vigorously disagreed with my take on a story, and I usually give the gentle reminder that I often frame things as being my opinion. A lot of the time I'll start off by saying the words I think, or I believe, or if you ask me, or it's just my opinion. I don't always say it, but if someone were to continue to tell me how I'm wrong, I'll leave another gentle reminder that anyone is free to start their own podcast and tell the stories that they want them heard. So I guess in a way, that's what I'm doing here, as I'm not seeing this story the same way, so I'm doing my own for this 169th episode of California Dreaming, The Tales of Skeletons in the Closet. When I began looking for articles about this story, there were two things that I wanted to know about. First, I wanted to know more about a man named Gonzalo Ramirez. And secondly, I wanted to know why I was feeling how I was feeling about the woman being interviewed on Dateline. While I didn't find very much out there about Gonzalo Ramirez, I did find that I was not alone when it came to the opinion that I was developing about this case and this woman's story, which was somewhat of a relief. Because the last thing I want to do here is minimize this woman's experience and what she went through or disregard the things that she has had to say. But it would be remiss of me to not, at the very least, share with you what is going on inside my head when I do listen and take in the things that she said and what I make of it all. What adds another layer to this is the fact that this woman is a PhD, a professor of psychology. That fact gets thrown around a lot throughout this story, but as we go along, it becomes less and less relevant, if even it has any bearing on the most significant aspects of this case to even begin with. The woman that I've been referring to, her name is Norma Patricia Esparza. Throughout the case, she goes by the name Patricia, so we will call her that for this episode. She was born in a poor rural town in Mexico. And really, I don't know if there are any rural towns in Mexico that aren't impoverished. Like, I can't even remember hearing anyone ever say that they've come from a rich rural town in Mexico. But anyway, I digress. And the fact that Patricia had come from such a poverty-stricken background is also referenced throughout the telling of her story. If not for the reasons why this ended up on our podcast, this would have otherwise been a rather inspirational one. Coming from a family with very little means, immigrants who made their way to the United States for a better life, Patricia had overcome all of those hardships, earning even a full-ride scholarship to attend high school at the prestigious Phillips Exeter Academy in New Hampshire, one of the oldest and most elite boarding schools in the United States, which was established in 1781. Exactly how prestigious and elite is this place? Well, the annual tuition today is $44,960 if your student attends the school and lives off campus, or if your student is boarding, then the tuition is $57,563. Many of their students receive financial aid, and during non-pandemic times, the enrollment is around 1,000 students. The average class size is 12. On one of the podcasts that I had listened to, it is said that it's sort of an inside joke amongst Phillip Exeter students that if you don't get into an Ivy League, then you failed. Well, I guess they would have all considered Patricia a failure because instead of attending one of the 8 Ivy League institutions on the East Coast, she chose to attend a college back in California where her family was living. She went to Pomona College. It is a smaller school, but it is still prestigious nonetheless. While Pomona isn't far from where Patricia's family resided in Orange County, she did live on campus in a dorm. It would have been a nightmarish commute to make every day, and I believe she wasn't really driving at the time either. But living close to her family enabled Patricia to visit her mother and her siblings pretty much every weekend. And that is basically what was going on in Patricia's life at the time when this case that we're discussing today would begin. But backing up a little bit to Patricia's childhood, she has claimed that in addition to being poor, she grew up in a family that was quite dysfunctional, with a father who she described as extremely violent and abusive. Patricia said her mother was subjected to vicious beatings inflicted by her father, and then, around the time Patricia turned 5, her father began abusing her sexually. And I believe she said that the abuse lasted about 7 years, so to the age of 12. This would be leading up to the time that Patricia was in middle school, maybe a year or so before she went off to boarding school in New Hampshire. So when we come to find that this child had been abused by her father over a long period of time, it is indeed quite an amazing accomplishment for her to have been able to have that going on in her life, yet she continued to soar academically, maintaining her high achievements. So how did Patricia do it? Well, according to what she has said in her interviews, the manner in which she coped was she immersed herself in her studies. She said that she had nobody that she could turn to for help. Her dad being her abuser, she obviously couldn't get help from him. Her mom couldn't help because she couldn't even help herself as she was suffering the physical abuse. So Patricia turned her focus onto her academics and education. So dreamers, what we have here is Patricia laying the foundation of what we are going to see become a pattern in her life. She's become a victim of abuse at a very young age, allegedly at the hands of her father. She said her father was extremely violent and abusive towards her mother, then he abused her sexually for several years. But she was able to stay focused on school and continued to excel academically, even going so far as to earning a full ride scholarship to Phillips Exeter. It's a triumphant tale of overcoming adversity against all odds. In Patricia's interview, it was said that both her mother and her sister were unaware of the abuse at the time that it was taking place, but they found out about it many years later. And Patricia's brother has said that their father told him that he abused Patricia, but otherwise would never speak to anybody, including the media, about those claims. In reflecting upon the abuse, Patricia has said that the experience with her father caused her to develop feelings of terror and fear towards men, as well as caused her to be very vulnerable and easily influenced and controlled when it comes to men. And this is where I begin to question some of the details of this story. It wasn't right away, though. So when I went back and re-listened a couple more times, that's when there started to be a few things that didn't sound quite right to me. And I will come back to this a little bit later, how the abuse that Patricia said that she suffered at the hands of her father and how that shaped her feelings towards men. So Patricia went away for 4 years for high school in New Hampshire, but came back to California in order to attend college closer to home. By 1995, Patricia was 20, and various articles have said at the time she was a sophomore at Pomona College, so despite having exhibited academic excellence, she wasn't ahead in school. She had not skipped grades. As a matter of fact, she may have even been slightly behind. And perhaps it had something to do with when she moved from Mexico to California. I don't know. But she would be turning 21 in 1995, so being a sophomore, it's slightly behind, considering how much she'd had excelled. It obviously didn't matter, and it may have even been to her advantage, but just a minor detail in the story. So at this time, she was a sophomore in college. Patricia described herself as one who continued to take her studies very seriously, even here at the college level. She said she wasn't the type to have gotten caught up in the typical partying that goes on. She wasn't a drinker. She didn't do much of anything outside of her coursework. But there was one particular weekend when she was home in Santa Ana visiting her family at her mom's house, when she and her older sister and a friend decided to go out on a Saturday night. On the evening of March 25th, 1995, the trio went to a nightclub called El Cortez. This was a place at the time that was very popular on the weekends because they had featured live bands. It was there Patricia met a man named Gonzalo Ramirez. They danced a couple of songs, and the two did end up exchanging phone numbers. However, in her interview with Dateline, Patricia was asked about what it was she found attractive about Gonzalo. And her answer to me was kind of wishy-washy. She said something to the effect that it wasn't that there was anything attractive or unattractive, he just seemed nice. At the time, Gonzalo was 25, so about 4 years older or so than Patricia. She danced with him, she traded phone numbers, but then in her interview, Patricia said she never thought she'd ever see this guy again, which I thought was a weird thing to say because she just said that they traded phone numbers, so to me, it kind of seemed like there may have been more of an expectation to hear from this guy as opposed to thinking she'd never see him again. And we've met guys and we've gotten numbers and we talk about it to our friends and either we're like, oh my gosh, he's really cute, or I hope he calls me, or he's super nice, he's a good dancer, things like that. If you're interested in a guy, you're not necessarily going to give him your phone number, right? Or if you just don't want it to get weird, maybe you'll give him the wrong number or something like that. I don't know, but you're going to come to see that when you listen to Patricia talk, you're going to feel that there is this need to analyze everything that she says and the manner in which she says it, so you can measure the veracity of what she's saying. And if you're feeling like she's being candid and forthcoming, at least that's what was going on with me, because something just wasn't sitting right as I listened. And at the time she's giving this interview, she's been a professor for quite some time. So every little moment matters, especially when a case like this comes along that's so confusing and you're really not sure what's going on. It's those small moments, you know, the things that are going on beneath the surface. And it bothered me that when she met a guy, danced with him, gave him her number, took his phone number, but topped it off by saying that he was all right, there was nothing attractive or unattractive about him, and I didn't think I was going to see him again. As she talked about this encounter with Gonzalo, she was like, whatever about it. But I just felt like there was more to it than that. The next day, Gonzalo did call her. He invited her, but also her sister and the friend, out to breakfast, which seemed like a really sweet gesture on his part, at least to me anyway. So they all went out to breakfast that Sunday, March 26th. Afterwards, it would have been getting close to time when Patricia and her friend, a fellow student, needed to get back to campus. So Gonzalo offered to give them a ride, which Patricia and the friend accepted. When they got to the campus, they dropped off the friend, and Gonzalo and Patricia walked around the campus for a little bit. At some point, Gonzalo told her that he was thirsty. He asked for a glass of water, so they went up to her dorm. I do take a little bit of an issue with Gonzalo asking for water and Patricia being so apparently willing to invite Gonzalo up to her dorm room for this glass of water when she really doesn't know this person very well, but according to her, she allowed it. She's never said she hesitated or took the fact that he was virtually a stranger when he asked for water and subsequently allowed him to come up to her dorm. Now, don't get me wrong here. I absolutely believe Patricia, or any woman for that matter, should be able to invite a person into their home and fully expect that they are safe. In a perfect world, right? But we don't live in a perfect world. And I understand that Patricia is young at this time. She may be somewhat naive, and I'm willing to give her that. But it seems to me as though she might have known to err on the side of caution a little bit more. But in addition to that, she has said that the abuses that she endured for 7 years of her childhood, most of her formative years, caused her to develop an immense terror and fear of men. So the willingness to have somebody that she barely knows come up to her dorm is incongruent with the fear and terror that she said she had when it came to men. Is it possible that she let her guard down? Is it possible that Gonzalo may have been charming and was able to easily win her trust? I mean, he did invite her and her sister and her friend to breakfast. That was well played, right? Well, anyway, Patricia and Gonzalo ended up in her dorm room. In an article in OrangeCoast.com from back in 2014, it detailed how Patricia described what happened next. She said that Gonzalo wanted to have sex. She told him no, but he continued to persist. A struggle ensued while he proceeded to pull her pants off. He was able to overpower her and pin her down and rape her. So here we have, for the second time in this story, Patricia describing another time in her life when she was victimized by a man, this time an intimate partner. Another situation she found herself subjected to sexual violence in which she was completely vulnerable and helpless. And I do want to point out that Patricia did not call the police and report the alleged sexual assault. not to the campus police, nor to the regular police. A few months later, however, she would be questioned by police conducting an investigation, which we will get to. I don't want to get ahead of myself here. Where Patricia would be asked some questions about Gonzalo Ramirez and how she knew him. She explained that she met him at a club a couple of months prior. And eventually, and somewhat reluctantly, Patricia alleged to these detectives questioning her that she was, in fact, raped by Gonzalo. She described what happened, and then she said, quote, "I kind of blanked out. It was like, it's going to be better for you if you just go on with it, if you pretend that you wanted it." She next told these detectives that the following morning she paid a visit to the health clinic where she saw a nurse and received a morning after pill. She also told police that she told the nurse that she had been date raped, but did not report it because she said, quote, "I figured nothing was going to get done." Now, in Patricia's interview with Dateline, she told the same story, but with some slight differences. She said, quote, "When we were inside, he tells me that he wants to have sex. And I tell him, no, I'm not interested. He starts to get aggressive and starts to try and kiss me. And I push him away. We're struggling. And then ultimately, he takes off my pants and he forces himself on me. When he's finished, I just turned away from him and half naked, I curled up into a ball and I just started sobbing. When he gets to the door, he tells me, 'You have a lot of problems,' and he walks away." While I have absolutely no basis whatsoever to say this did not happen the way that Patricia described this interaction with a nurse occurred, I would be lying to you if I told you that I'm skeptical. And the reason I'm skeptical is because Patricia told police back in 1995 that she went to the nurse for a morning after pill. But then years later, when she was on Dateline, she made no mention of asking or receiving a morning after pill. And in addition to that, in her first version to police, she said she told the nurse that she was date raped, but chose not to report it because she figured nothing would get done. But in her Dateline interview, she placed the responsibility of the failure to report on the nurse that she had visited. She told the nurse that she had been raped, but Patricia said that the nurse made her feel ashamed, she didn't want to deal with it, and she walked away. Those are two very different versions of what happened. I want to tell you that in the second podcast that I listened to about this case, they made a big deal about this rape allegation on Patricia's part being a result of college campuses historically making a concerted effort to cover up as many incidents of sexual assault as they possibly can. And part of that cover-up involves the underreporting of sexual assaults when they do occur on their campuses. That too many sexual assaults is detrimental to the college's reputation, to their enrollment, and their bottom line. While I don't disagree with the notion that sexual assaults do go underreported, not just in colleges, but in general, I do have to disagree that Patricia's alleged rape allegations never being officially reported to police had anything to do with the college covering up or underreporting. In her own words, Patricia said she didn't report it because she figured nothing was going to get done. That is unrelated to college underreporting. And I hung on to those words for a while. Nothing was going to get done. What did Patricia mean by that? Why did she say it and why did she feel that way? In the times that I've known of situations where victims of sexual assault chose not to report, it often had to do with embarrassment or shame, self-doubt, self-blame, fear, things like that, you know, emotional reasons. But to decide to not go to police because nothing was going to get done, it really doesn't make all that much sense to me. The only way to ensure nothing will get done is to stay silent. So Patricia assumed here that if she reported Gonzalo for allegedly sexually assaulting her, police wouldn't get anything done. What does that even mean? How does she know if she doesn't take the first steps to report it? If Patricia had said she didn't report the rape because she was afraid or ashamed, I would have actually not even thought twice about it and moved on from this discussion. Shame and fear are absolutely valid reasons for a woman to choose to stay quiet. Should a woman be made to stay quiet? Should she be made to feel shame? Should she be made to feel fear? No. No and no. And hopefully those social stigmas that are slowly changing for the better, as it seems that women have been made to feel more empowered over the last few years as a result of the Me Too movement. But still, it does not change the fact that surviving sexual assault is still and always will be a deeply personal thing to deal with and work through. And there are always going to be women and men who will feel fear and shame and choose not to come forward, no matter how many survivors out there stand up and speak up. So what I am feeling here with Patricia's statement that nothing would get done, it sounds like a little bit of an excuse for not saying anything. Just blame it on the college, blame it on the nurse, blame it on police, assuming that they'd all collectively fail to take action if she were to report the rape, so she decided not to. In an odd way, it kind of sounds like it just wasn't important to her to have made that report. Like, she just sort of brushed it aside because nothing was going to get done. Nothing getting done started with her failure to report. If she had reported the rape and then nothing ever got done, then that would mean law enforcement dropped the ball. But Patricia was the one who needed to get the ball rolling in the first place. But then Patricia's story about this changed again in her telling to Dateline. On the show, it was said that Patricia didn't call the police, but the next day she went to her college health center where she saw a nurse, but says the nurse didn't take any action to report her rape allegation. She said, quote, "I told her that I had been raped, and I remember her reaction because it just made me feel so ashamed. She didn't want to deal with it. She walked away." This is vastly different than what she had told law enforcement when she said she didn't report the rape because nothing would get done. So here we have Patricia being victimized again for a third time by the nurse on her college campus, who she alleges didn't want to deal with it, gave her a morning after pill, and walked away. I'm not completely clear as to what responsibility the nurse on a college campus has when it comes to reporting a crime like this, if the victim herself isn't wanting to report it. I mean, if Patricia said to the nurse that she had been raped but is too afraid or ashamed to report it, is the nurse obligated to take any steps towards reporting it herself? I'm not sure. Maybe some of you out there know. So when Patricia's second version of this interaction with the nurse, when she said the nurse didn't take any actions to report her rape, I'm not 100% sure what the nurse was supposed to have done if Patricia herself had no intentions of making the report. I can't imagine a nurse behaving that way towards a victim of sexual assault, making her feel so ashamed and not wanting to deal with it. If that was truly the case, then clearly this person has no business being a nurse. And another thing that's been kind of bugging me here is the part where Patricia said that when Gonzalo was finished allegedly raping her, he walked away and told her, "You have a lot of problems." But Patricia put no context around it, so I've been trying to figure out what could have transpired between the two of them for him to have made that statement to her, if he did in fact say it. What did he mean by that? "You've got a lot of problems." What would cause him to tell this girl a statement like that? To me, it kind of sounds like Patricia may have been saying or doing something that Gonzalo picked up on. I mean, at this point, he was 4 or 5 years older than Patricia, and he was the father of 2 young children, their babies. So he probably would have had a little bit of more insight into whatever was going on with Patricia, maybe more so than she expected him to have. Because look, based on what we know so far about Patricia and her life, when Gonzalo said that, he wasn't wrong. Patricia excelled academically, but below the surface, she has alleged that she was sexually abused for 7 years when she was a child and young teen. That is a lot of problems. But why would Gonzalo say that to her supposedly after he raped her? It seems like a bizarre thing to be the parting words of a rapist. But in what context would a statement like that actually make some sense? It's really difficult to get into specifics because we don't really know all that happened between Patricia and Gonzalo. We only know what she says happened. But it kind of sounds like something that may have been said on his part out of frustration caused by something that Patricia had told him, or how she may have been acting. Like maybe she said something or did something and he was like, you know what? You've got a lot of problems, and then left. It sounds like a moment where he realized that this girl may have been cute and fun to dance with, but man, she's got a lot of problems, and he walked away not wanting to get caught up. To me, it seems like Gonzalo blew her off and was not interested in getting to know her any further. Remember, they'd only met the night before. They hadn't even known each other for a half a day at most. And it only took a couple of hours of hanging out and talking while they weren't in a nightclub for Gonzalo to see that this girl's got a lot of problems. I don't know. I wish I knew the context in which this statement was made. But Patricia says he said it when he was leaving after having raped her. I find it to be kind of a non sequitur, really, in this situation. Well, as it would turn out, Gonzalo Ramirez would end up being the one with a lot of problems. Problems much, much worse than whatever problems he supposedly referred to when he left Patricia's apartment that Sunday, March 26th. Exactly 3 weeks to the day after the two met on the dance floor at the El Cortez nightclub, Gonzalo was kidnapped. The following morning, his body was found dumped somewhere along the 405 freeway in the city of Irvine. And dreamers, his death was brutal. The manner in which this man was killed is likely to be one of the reasons why this was never going to go away for the investigators who would end up working on this case. On the evening of Saturday, April 15th, 1995, Gonzalo and a friend of his named Noel Reyes had gone to the El Cortez. From what I gathered, it was a place that Gonzalo frequented on the weekends. They were there for a part of the evening until they decided to head home. They were in Gonzalo's truck. He was driving and Noel was the passenger. And about a mile and a half from the club, while stopped at a red light, the truck that they were driving was struck in the rear by a white van. It was by no means a major accident. It was a very minor collision, investigators describing it as nothing more than a fender bender. For some reason, Noel didn't want to stop. He didn't want to pull over and get out of the car to assess the damages. He just wanted to keep going and worry about it later. But Gonzalo didn't want to do that, telling his friend that they needed to stop so they could exchange information. I'm sure that Gonzalo thought that if there was some damage done to his truck, that he didn't want to walk away from the accident without getting the other driver's info so he could make an insurance claim. But Gonzalo's friend felt differently about it. I don't know if he had a bad feeling about the whole situation. I mean, it was late at night. But maybe Gonzalo and Noel had been drinking and they didn't want to get in any more trouble in case police were going to be called to the scene of the accident. Whatever the reason, Noel wanted to cut their losses and go, but Gonzalo didn't want to do that. When Gonzalo pulled over and got out of his truck, Noel stayed inside, but he turned around to see what was going on. That's when Noel saw two men and one woman seated in the van. One of the men got out of the van, approached Gonzalo, and suddenly began attacking him, throwing punches. Noel immediately got out of the truck to help Gonzalo, but that's when the second man in the white van spotted Noel and got out of his vehicle too. Noel was afraid that the second man may have been armed with a weapon, so he decided to retreat and attempted to look for someone in any nearby business that could help or call for help. Noel ran, heading northbound on the street that they had been on, and eventually found a security guard working at a Motel 6, not too far away from where the intersection where the accident took place. But by the time Noel and the guard returned to the scene, all that was left was Gonzalo's truck, still parked there where it had been rear-ended, as well as some evidence of a struggle on the street near the truck. This included one shoe that was believed to have belonged to Gonzalo, a wristwatch that had been torn off the wrist of whomever was wearing it, and some small drops of blood. The van, its passengers, and Gonzalo were all gone, and it appeared as though he had been kidnapped. And the way this all happened, beginning with the accident, it is believed that everything was staged in order to get Gonzalo to exit his vehicle. So with that detail, the early theory was is that this was a planned event and that Gonzalo was specifically targeted. This did not appear to be a random crime, and there were no clues as to what have been the motive behind it all. All Noel knew was that his friend was gone, and he was going to have to call Gonzalo's family to break the news to them that he was missing. Gonzalo's family got word that Sunday morning. Around 3 a.m. is when Noel called to get in touch with them and explain what had happened that night. This was Easter Sunday when Gonzalo's brother, Carlos, received this awful news. He began calling around to Gonzalo's friends to see if any of them had heard from him, but nobody had. Not wanting to just sit there and do nothing, Carlos got into his car and began driving around to various places he thought that he might be able to find Gonzalo. He searched all night but came up with nothing and no information as to where his brother may have been. However, it was a little bit after 8 a.m. that Easter morning when Irvine police got a report that a body had been discovered. It was a body that appeared to have been dumped just off the freeway. Investigators who had been assigned to this case were at home, of course. It was Sunday and it was a holiday, so when the call came in and it was from their sergeant, they knew that it was a bad situation, but they really had no idea just how bad it would really turn out to be. The seasoned detectives who ended up at the scene, while they had seen plenty of things throughout their careers, this particular death was next level. What set this particular killing apart, and it was a murder, it was clearly a murder, what set it apart was how extensively the victim had been injured. The detectives described the victim as having been hacked to death, his body having been covered with dozens and dozens of slices. Slices made with a weapon that seemed to have been something like a machete or a meat cleaver. And you know, this is Southern California. A young Hispanic man getting killed now and then isn't uncommon, but Gonzalo's death could have been very easily categorized as such. As a matter of fact, at times, the family had feared that his death would be filed along with dozens and dozens of young murdered Hispanic men that never got solved. But the fact that Gonzalo had literally been hacked up with a meat cleaver or something similar so badly that some of his fingers had been completely severed off and his right hand was barely attached to his wrist anymore. The fact that this had been so gruesome, it stood apart from the average run-of-the-mill murder. It was also unusual that a crime like this would have ended up in Irvine, a city which can frequently be found at the top of the list when it comes to safest cities in California. And this is why, even though this case is going to twist and turn all over the place for years and years to come, investigators were never going to forget Gonzalo Ramirez and the brutal manner in which he was killed. Another interesting detail about what was found along with Gonzalo's mutilated body is that there were some unique blue-colored towels wrapped around him. The towels had been wrapped numerous times around his head, covering his eyes, several times around his neck, wrapped all the way up and down the trunk of his body and his legs. And from the looks of the crime, the manner in which it was carried out, the up-close way Gonzalo was killed, the investigators surmised that this crime was personal, that there must have been some high levels of emotion involved here. The way Gonzalo had been hacked so many times all over his body, it spoke to the investigators, hinting that whoever did this was in a rage. But before they could go anywhere else with this investigation, they needed to figure out who this man was. He didn't have any identification on him or in his pockets. So before they were ever going to begin to try and figure out why, they needed to figure out who. We know that Gonzalo's family were informed early Sunday morning by Noel that they had been involved in some sort of accident, that by now they were fairly certain it was staged in order to get Gonzalo to get out of his truck, that he had been kidnapped, and that he was missing. Easter passed with the family still searching, hoping that he'd turn up, of course, alive and well. But by Monday, the news had spread that an unidentified body had been found along the 405 freeway in Irvine. So when Gonzalo heard this, they had hoped it wasn't him, but they needed to find out. So Gonzalo's brother, Carlos, contacted the Irvine police. He told them that his brother was missing, that he was driving with a friend when their vehicle was rear-ended by a white van, and when everyone got out of their vehicles to assess the damage and exchange information, Gonzalo was attacked and taken away, presumably by these people in the van. And he said that he was hoping that the body that had been found wasn't his brother, but he needed to make that confirmation. It did not take long for police to confirm that the victim was indeed Gonzalo Ramirez, and they had the family come and make that positive identification. It is my understanding that his brother was the one who ID'd Gonzalo, and he said in his interview on Dateline that he was barely recognizable. His face had been hacked up. It was beyond anything that they could have imagined. It was so vicious and brutal. Gonzalo Ramirez was only 25 years old. He had two children, and they were only 1 and 2 years old at the time, now left to be raised without their father. Gonzalo's family were emphatic. He was a good man and a loving father, and that he was very responsible and cannot understand how something like this could have happened to him. Of course, we know that Patricia Esparza will have a very different opinion of Gonzalo. And dreamers, that is part of what I wanted to try to sort through here as we go along. Was Gonzalo a loving, responsible father? Or was he a violent predator or rapist? And is it possible that he's both? Fortunately for investigators, they had an eyewitness to the attack and kidnapping. Gonzalo's friend, Noel, who had gone out with him that night to the El Cortez. And he was able to provide some pretty good details and information when it came to the men who attacked Gonzalo and the vehicle that they had been driving. But the friend had no clue as to who these people were. He didn't recognize them as anybody Gonzalo was acquainted with, and he certainly had no idea how or why this minor car accident ended up with Gonzalo being taken, tortured, murdered, and dumped. So the place that investigators needed to start was with their victim. Understanding who Gonzalo was and what was going on in his life at the time that he was murdered. Who around him may have had a reason to want to do this to him? Did he owe somebody some money? Was there some issue with a former or current romantic partner? They were going to try and put together a victimology profile and go from there. And they hoped they'd be able to shake loose some clues to lead to some suspects. Investigators spoke to a number of Gonzalo's friends and members of his family, but nothing came of that. Nobody had any idea why Gonzalo was murdered. Eventually, however, after a search of Gonzalo's place of residence, investigators noticed that a name and phone number had been written down on his telephone bill. It was the name Patty, followed by two phone numbers. As it turned out, this Patty was Patricia Esparza, the young woman Gonzalo had met at El Cortez back on March 25th and had gone to breakfast with the following morning. Detectives wanted to get in touch with this Patty and to see if she had any information that would be able to shine some light on the investigation. But so far, in the weeks following Gonzalo's murder, they had come up with nothing in the way of viable leads. No information, no suspects. And I just want to quickly remind us all here, if you recall, in Patricia's interview on Dateline, she said Gonzalo was a guy that she didn't think she'd ever see again. And here we find out that not only did she give Gonzalo her phone number, she gave him two phone numbers. I don't know what the two phone numbers were. Cell phones weren't everywhere yet, but they were becoming a thing by the mid to late 90s. It could have been a cell phone line or a landline, or it could have been a pager. Those were a thing back in those days. Whatever the case was, Patricia said that she may have thought Gonzalo wasn't going to call her, that she was never going to see him again. He was like, whatever. The fact that she not only gave him one number, she gave him two. And to me, that kind of seems like something she'd do because she wanted to hear from him. And I just say this because I think she was trying to downplay her interest in Gonzalo. In a story like this, the way Patricia tells it, you're going to come to find that how she says things and the words she chooses all seem to have an underlying purpose. No matter how tiny the detail, when you put it all together, it paints a different picture than the one Patricia is always trying to present. Patricia had been asked to come in for questioning sometime in June of 1995, somewhere in the ballpark of about 3 months after Gonzalo was murdered. She sat down with two very seasoned Santa Ana detectives to discuss what she had to say about Gonzalo. At the time, Patricia was still 20-ish years old. I mentioned she was born in 1974, but I wasn't able to find a date. She told the detectives that she had met Gonzalo back in March at the nightclub, that they talked a little bit, they danced a couple of songs, that they seemed to both like each other, and they ended up exchanging phone numbers. How is it that Patricia's number came to be written down on his phone bill at with the place where he lived? My best guess is that Patricia may have given her number to him on a scrap piece of paper or on a receipt or a napkin, and when he got home the next morning, he just jotted it down on his phone bill. Eventually, Patricia opened up about how Gonzalo allegedly sexually assaulted her the following day after they met in her dorm room, and that it had occurred about 2.5 months earlier. So that would put this first meeting with police that Patricia had towards the beginning of June, since the alleged assault happened on March 26th. She described what happened between the two of them and admitted that she did not contact police to file a report about the rape. This interview was the first time that she had told any law enforcement personnel or agency about it. The one thing police did make a mental note of is as they were talking and speaking to Patricia about Gonzalo, there was never a time when Patricia inquired as to what she had been called in to the police station for. They had found her phone number at Gonzalo's home. They called her up. They asked her to come down to the station, which she readily did and agreed to do. They began asking questions about Gonzalo and how she came to know him. Not one time did she ask about, like, what is this all about? Why are you guys asking me about this person? I mean, okay, she claimed to have been raped by this guy, right? And she even told the investigators about it, albeit reluctantly, which is very understandable coming from the perspective of the victim. It can't be easy to sit there and talk to two men who are strangers about something so intimate and personal and traumatic. But still, I think it would be natural for the average person to ask why. Why am I here? Why are you talking to me about this person? Did he hurt somebody else? But no, Patricia never asked, and they never did tell her that Gonzalo had been murdered. They simply wanted to hear what Patricia had to say, and hearing this information was somewhat of a plot twist for investigators. Because eventually, Patricia explained to the officers that she had been struggling in the aftermath of the rape. So the first and only person she confided in about it was an ex-boyfriend named Gianni Van. They had dated for about 7 months, she said, but they had broken up a couple months earlier. Now, if Patricia's timeline is accurate here, then the breakup between herself and Gianni would have happened close to the time when she met Gonzalo. At least, that's about all the math I can do based on Patricia's statement that they had broken up, quote-unquote, a couple months earlier. However, making the statement in June of 1995 to police, and then she's estimating that she and Gianni broke up in April, that would be a couple months earlier. That would also make her meeting Gonzalo on the evening of March 25th having happened while she was still actively dating Gianni. And because she referred to him as her ex-boyfriend, to me that indicates that their relationship was a committed, monogamous one. While investigators never really put this timeline together, I am by no means trying to say that they didn't do their due diligence, because I'm looking at this case with the added benefit of hindsight. And I hadn't really picked up on this tidbit of info right away either. Not until I was putting together a clear timeline of what happened in this case. Anyway, what this tells me is if the timeline that Patricia is providing is accurate, it's telling me that when Patricia gave Gonzalo her phone number and when she accepted his, she was still in a relationship with Gianni Van. On the surface, it may seem somewhat of an insignificant detail, but I think as the story progresses, it is those little details that may hold the answers to some of the unanswered questions in the story. There were also some slight discrepancies in Patricia's story when it comes to the reasons why Gianni Van went to Patricia's dorm in the first place when she ended up confiding in him about being raped by Gonzalo. It's not a major discrepancy, but still, I do want to note the changes Patricia makes, big or small, each time she recounts what happened. When Patricia spoke to Dateline, she said Gianni had come to visit her at her dorm one day, and it was during this visit that she opened up as to what happened. She said she broke down and told him that Gonzalo had raped her. The correspondent on Dateline asked, that must have been hard to finally open up, and Patricia answered, yeah, I didn't feel that I wanted to, but I guess I wanted somebody to be there and understand. I wanted somebody to listen to me and just make me feel that I wasn't so dirty and ashamed. The correspondent asked if he helped her, and Patricia said that he did at first. She had said earlier in this interview that in the wake of the alleged rape that her life was falling apart. She said, quote, I was weeping and crying. It was really hard to pull myself together. I wasn't doing my assignments as I should have. My grades were dropping, and so I wasn't able to deal with the rape as well as I wished I had. When Patricia spoke to police during that initial questioning back in June of 1995, she told them she confided in her ex-boyfriend that she had been raped. In a 2014 article about this case in OCWeekly.com, Patricia said that the rape has haunted her ever since it had happened, and she explained that the reason why she didn't report it to authorities is because she felt so ashamed and she didn't want her family to find out about it. So here we have yet another reason, a different reason, why the alleged rape wasn't reported. Remember, Patricia first said that she didn't report it because nothing would get done. Then she said that the nurse was the one who shamed her and failed to take any action to report the rape. Now here she's saying she felt ashamed and didn't want her family to know about it. Now, before anyone wants to jump all over me for being so skeptical here with Patricia's story, I want you to know that I mulled this case over for a long time. And I wanted to present it based on what Patricia Esparza has said over the years in her own words. As this case came roaring back into the headlines nearly two decades after Gonzalo was murdered, with the advent of social media and the changing views on sexual assault, victim blaming, and victim shaming, Patricia had been able to develop a very strong base of support as a sexual assault survivor. After all, this is a woman who had seemingly overcome so many atrocious things that had happened to her in her childhood and adolescence and when she was a young adult. She pushed through all of it and continued to maintain her high achievements in school, eventually becoming a PhD, a professor of psychology. Despite being allegedly sexually assaulted by Gonzalo Ramirez, she continued on. But going over Patricia's various tellings of her story, I have to point it out when things aren't really adding up or making sense or maintaining consistency. The truth doesn't change, even the slightest. And I don't think those changes should just be ignored. So when I say I mulled this over for a while, I did. Because I was and am having this feeling that my opinion was going to be an unpopular one. What I kept seeing, particularly back in the early 2010s, is that Patricia was raped and her rapist was murdered, so too bad for him. I really don't want to get raked over the coals for this, but I just couldn't get on board with that sentiment. And it's not because I don't get it or I don't understand what it's like, or I'm completely out of touch, or I have no idea what I'm talking about. And that's because, well, if I'm being completely truthful here in bearing my soul, me too. So on many levels, I get it. But the fact is, the more I looked into Patricia's case, I started having questions that I wanted to try to find answers to. Even though the sympathy may run very, very thin for Gonzalo as he's been accused of rape, there is little sympathy to be had as a result of his murder. We shouldn't forget a couple of key points about him, though. Gonzalo Ramirez was never reported to police. He was never charged with any crime related to Patricia's allegations. The only evidence we have that Gonzalo raped Patricia is her word. Even the records that were available regarding Patricia's visit to the campus health center indicated that she was seen and given a morning after pill. Nothing indicated that she alleged a rape had taken place. And most importantly, Gonzalo was never given the opportunity to answer to these charges. He was never given the chance to defend himself. And he never would be able to because he was murdered 3 weeks after he met Patricia Esparza. Getting back to what I was saying about the discrepancies in Patricia's story regarding the visit she got from Gianni a couple weeks after the alleged rape, I said a moment ago that she told Deadline that he stopped by to see her at her dorm. But later on in sworn testimony, she said that he came by because he wanted to talk about the status of their relationship and that he wanted to get back together. She had never said that previously, but I think adding that small change in the details makes a little bit more sense in terms of Gianni just randomly showing up at her dorm. She hadn't given a reason about that visit initially, but then years later she said it was an attempt on his part to rekindle their relationship. When Patricia was asked if he made her feel better when she was finally able to open up to somebody about the rape, she said she did at first. But according to Patricia, that quickly turned into anger. And it wasn't simply anger towards Gonzalo for allegedly raping her, but Patricia said he was angry at her, extremely angry, and blamed her directly for what had happened. According to Patricia, Gianni became enraged and accused her of allowing this to happen. So here now we have Patricia telling us that Gianni, the one person she chose to confide in, to look towards for comfort and support, that instead of providing that, he rather re-victimized her by blaming her for her own sexual assault. What I'm getting at here is another pattern I'm picking up on when it comes to Patricia and the way things happen to her and the way she handles them. When it came to the sexual abuse she said she endured at the hands of her father between the ages of 5 and 12, she said there was nobody that she could turn to for help, which is understandable. She was very young. She couldn't turn to her mom because her mom was regularly beaten by her father, so she thought that her mom was as helpless as she was. Patricia had an older sister, but she never mentioned contemplating turning to her for help or support. Also, understandable. Patricia has never alleged that her sister was being abused too. So she may have known or felt she was being targeted or singled out by her father, and that it was something that she was going to have to cope with alone, which she said she did by immersing herself in reading and studying. But Patricia said some years later she told her mother and sister about the sexual abuse, and her brother apparently found out about it directly from their father. From there, at the age of 20, Patricia was allegedly sexually assaulted by Gonzalo, an assault she never reported to police. She herself said when she was being abused by her dad, there was nobody to turn to. Of course, we can't expect a child to know or be able to have the courage to pick up the phone and call police. But it sounded like as a child, she in some ways contemplated looking for help and looking for ways to cope. So when the alleged sexual assault happened, she didn't turn to police because she figured that nothing would get done. When she claimed she turned to the college nurse, that nurse failed to take action, that she didn't want to deal with it, and she gave her a morning after pill and walked away from her. And then Patricia said she spent the next 2 weeks weeping and crying and suffering and struggling through her schoolwork. Her grades were dropping, assignments weren't getting done, and all of this was a direct result of the trauma of the rape. Now, I realize these situations are different, but while Patricia had described her way of coping with the sexual abuse as a child was to focus on academics, it looks as though the opposite is happening here, and Patricia failed to find any way to cope with it the way she had when she was younger. She had been strong, and she demonstrated that even in the worst imaginable circumstances, and it doesn't get much worse than being sexually abused by your own father, Patricia continued to excel. Again, I know these situations are different and the way Patricia is dealing with these things are going to be different. But it would seem like the logical progression of things would dictate that Patricia is a person who would be able to not only overcome these terrible circumstances, but also flourish and thrive. And even though she said her life was falling apart, she still went on to earn her PhD, becoming Dr. Patricia Esparza, and teaching psychology at the university level. Many, many survivors wallow in the trauma that's left behind after being sexually assaulted. Many never really fully recover. They are often never going to be the same as they were before the assault. Some do push past it and are able to pick up the pieces of their shattered world and have some semblance of normalcy. But Patricia here, going on to achieve the things she did, not only proved that it is possible to rise above it all, but she managed to do it with an immeasurable amount of strength and resolve. And it's the kind of strength that I've been under the impression that Patricia isn't capable of. At least I wouldn't think so if she had not been such an incredibly high-achieving woman. In her interviews and when she speaks, Patricia is incredibly diminutive and meek. She is very petite and she comes across as extremely timid and demure. At least that's the impression she's giving off throughout her entire interview on Dateline. But there are several other instances when Patricia doesn't always end up being as fearful and mousy as she appears or wants to appear. And I'll touch on that as we go along here. All of that being said, when we consider the people in Patricia's life, all of those people around her, her friends, her family, why would she have chosen Gianni Van, a guy she only dated for 7 months, to confide in about something so serious and personal? I wondered about that a lot without knowing anything about their relationship, how it went or why it ended, and what kind of person Gianni was. I can only guess. I understand not wanting to tell her family about what happened, but according to Patricia, her mom and her sister were very well aware of the years of abuse that she alleged to have suffered at the hands of her father. She didn't turn to them when she was young, but eventually she opened up to them about it, so we know that they knew. At least we think they knew that they were aware of the hurt and the pain that Patricia had gone through in the past. So why she held back in confiding in them about being allegedly sexually assaulted by Gonzalo, I don't know. We can make some assumptions. She said that she was ashamed. Well, she said she was ashamed about what happened and didn't report it to the police because she didn't want her family to find out. But you know, she could have made the police report without telling her family. She didn't live with them. She could have dealt with it privately and on her own. But she did say that she didn't want her family to know. I don't know if Patricia had any close friends at the time, and I don't know why I have this feeling, but I keep having the impression that Patricia didn't have very many close friends. It's only an impression on my part because she spent her entire young life and early adulthood pursuing her education. She managed to achieve so much in that sense. It seems like she wouldn't have had very much time for a big social circle of friends. But she seemed to be actively dating or wanting to date. She had a short-lived relationship with Gianni, and then she met and exchanged numbers with Gonzalo, so she wasn't completely closed off when it came to dating and romantic relationships. But why Gianni? Why did she tell him? She said she thought she could deal with it on her own, but she guessed that she apparently needed to open up to someone about it, someone who would listen and understand, so she chose an ex-boyfriend. He had come over that day, she said, and tried to rekindle their relationship, though Patricia didn't give any details as to how she felt about the possibility of that happening. She just said that he wanted to get back together. She didn't say that they wanted to get back together. She didn't say that they had been entertaining the possibility of getting back together. She just said that he wanted to get back together, so it gives the impression that the feeling was exclusive to him. So she chose that time when he came over to express his desires to get back together to tell him that she had been sexually assaulted. She said that when he came to the door, she had been sobbing and in tears, and he asked her what was wrong and she told him what happened. I've thought a lot about this. I tried to put myself in Patricia's place. This conversation with Gianni, I believe it took place about 3 days before Gonzalo was murdered. A boyfriend who she'd been broken up with randomly shows up and finds her broken down into tears, and from there she tells him that she was raped. On Dateline, Patricia said she was looking for someone to confide in, and Gianni was understanding at first, but then suddenly, inexplicably, he became enraged. He totally flip-flopped. I found this reaction on Gianni's part, as described by Patricia, to be interesting, for lack of a better word. Patricia had been broken down into tears when he arrived. He asked her what was wrong, which seems like a typical reaction. Find out what she's crying about and offer comfort, right? She's in tears. She opens up about what happened. 99% of the time, somebody in Gianni's position would try to offer comfort and a shoulder to cry on, to be calming and understanding and offer support. After all, this is the young lady that he had been involved with for a little while. It wasn't that long of a relationship, but they'd been close for a time. She opened up to him, and it would make sense that he would try to listen and help. But instead, he became so angry. In her interview on Dateline, she said that it makes sense that if any of us had a friend or a sister that had been raped, to be angry towards the attacker, that's a normal reaction. That is how Patricia first tried to frame Gianni's reaction, that he was angry at this man who had raped somebody that he cared about. But we are going to come to find that Gianni's anger, according to Patricia, was allegedly not directed at her rapist, but rather he was angry at her and blaming her for allowing what happened to her to happen. Back in 1995, when Patricia was being questioned by those two Santa Ana detectives, they asked her if she had a boyfriend at the time. She said that she did, and that his name was Gianni. But she rolled back on that and said, well, he wasn't my boyfriend at the time. Actually, we had broken up. They asked him if he was upset, and Patricia said, of course he was. She told the detectives in 1995 that she admitted to Gianni that she had been raped by a man named Gonzalo, but she said when pressed by Gianni, she refused to give him any more information. She refused to tell him Gonzalo's last name or give him any ideas where he might be able to find him. She said the only thing she wanted from Gianni was comfort. She said she didn't want him to go looking for Gonzalo or to get involved in any sort of retaliation against him. And while she didn't tell police that Gianni was looking to track Gonzalo down to retaliate, she did say Gianni was very angry. So detectives thought they may have their first viable lead in Gonzalo's murder case. It was possible that Gonzalo could have been murdered by an angry ex-boyfriend. It was a lead that they, of course, would look into. But there were a couple of things that you listening need to remember and know about this June 1995 interview with Patricia that she gave to the Santa Ana detectives. One is that she sat there and said that she refused to give Gianni any information about her alleged rapist beyond his first name. She said she refused to tell him his last name. She refused to give Gianni any information as to where Gonzalo lived or where he could be found. And she said she told Gianni she didn't want him to seek Gonzalo in order to retaliate. So, short of getting any more information out of Patricia, it would be very difficult for Gianni to begin to try to look for Gonzalo. That is, without Patricia's help. Help in finding him and identifying him. Another thing to remember here is Patricia never asked why she was being questioned about Gonzalo. Once she was asked to come down to the police station, she had zero curiosity as to why she was being asked about this rando guy that she had met 3 months ago at a club. I'd be curious, but maybe Patricia was too nervous or too shy or intimidated. She just wanted to answer their questions and get out of there. Perhaps. Well, let me fill you in on this interesting little tidbit here. As Patricia sat there in that Santa Ana Police Station interrogation room, this interview was recorded, and some of that audio was played on Dateline. As she sat there across from those two seasoned detectives, Patricia, with a straight face and zero hesitation, lied directly to them. She never stammered, she never flinched. As she matter-of-factly told her story, she told them all lies. She may not have verbally told numerous lies, but she definitely withheld pertinent information. Big, huge, massive pieces of information. As she failed to tell the detectives that she was actually married to Gianni Van. Okay, I'm going to end part one here. Part two shouldn't take me too long to put together. Maybe a little bit longer than I first thought when I wrote this, my notes on this case. I know you don't like to wait. I don't like to either. Recently, one of my favorite podcasts, Invisible Choir, they've been putting out two-parters. And this host, his show is bi-weekly, so it seems like forever, right? Well, it's still worth it if it's a good enough show, so hey, you know, it is what it is. And you know me, I do what I can to stay on schedule with my quote-unquote weekly show. And it might be randomly sporadic, but the same can be said for my multi-parters. They will never be 2 weeks apart, I'm fairly certain about that. So bear with me, this case is kind of jumbled up in my mind and I'm trying to be sensitive, but I also want to be candid about how I feel, particularly when it comes to things like not believing some claims that might be made here. And you may not agree with me. There are video clips on YouTube about this story. There's a segment of Nancy Grace where she really lays into how Patricia Esparza has been treated by the justice system. So I know my opinion might not be the popular one, and I understand that. So we're going to pick it up from where Gianni Van becomes a bigger player in this story. And as always, thank you for listening. I'm your host, Roseanne, and until next time, sweet dreams.